As I mentioned last week, we're starting a study of the history of the church, and a history of the church is hard to do because it's big. It's got a lot of complex variables. I mentioned the book that I'm using as my main reference, which is Church History in Plain Language. Wonderful book, good book, simple to read. A lot of facts that I'm not going to bring out. Struggling a little bit today. Last week we started with the time frame from the apostles, maybe AD 30, the time of the death of Christ, up until AD 70, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. We're going to pick up today and we're going to cover about 230 years. We're going to cover from AD 70 to about 300 AD or 312 AD. And I'm pretty much following the organization of the book in terms of how they've laid out these sections of church history, because there are many ways you could divide church history up depending on your politics and your interest and all of that. And so I'm going to follow this one because it's as good as any, and it has the reference material that I'm interested in. So we're going to look today, and the title of this for part two is really the Age of the Universal Church. And I'll say this now, and then I'll pick it up near the end. The word for universal church, the Latin word for universal, is the word Catholic, small c, Catholic. And so in many of the commentaries, you will see the word Catholic used. Doesn't mean Roman Catholic. It simply means Catholic universal. So I'm going to use the word universal most of the time today, just because I don't want to confuse what we understand today with what I'm trying to get you to focus on. And so this is the age of the universal church. And as I mentioned last week, just as a start to get us thinking, by AD 70, the church was in the following condition. All of the apostles, with the exception of the apostle John, were gone. They had all been killed off, or they sort of disappeared in mysterious ways. But they were all gone. All of the books of the New Testament had been written, with the exception of the book of Revelation. So most of the New Testament canon was complete, although it wasn't viewed that way by the church. It was just viewed as a bunch of writings of the apostles. The church had existed as a splinter church of the Jewish faith. And so the church met in the Jewish synagogues. They met on Sunday, what they called the Lord's Day. It didn't interfere with the Sabbath worship of the Jews. And so the Jews were fairly content because they had pretty well, what they thought, killed off the leader of the movement to allow them to do what they're doing. They thought it would die off and it would be fine. What happened was, as the church grew and the ministry began to expand, Christians went to Jewish synagogues all over around the Mediterranean and began to preach and teach. And we see some of the effects of that when we read Paul's letters about some of the criticisms and the things that were happening. But on a larger scale, the thing that was happening was the church was turning more from a Jewish Christian sect of believers, of the Jewish faith, to one where more and more Hebrews or pagans were being brought in under the umbrella of Christianity. So Christianity was beginning to change from a Jewish base with a Christian bent to it, to now a Christian bent from a pagan base or from a Greek base. And so the nature of the church began to change. We saw the trouble when they elected Stephen as a deacon because of the split between the widows of the Hebrew Christians and the Jewish Christians and how they weren't being taken care of. And it was because of the mindset of the church. The mindset of the church was still a Hebrew mindset, which basically said, you know, all of these other people, they may be Christians, but they're not as good as we are. We're God's chosen people. We're the blessed ones. And so they had this disdain view of the other part of Christianity. We got up through AD 70, and the church began to groan under the pressure of all of these different personalities. And as I mentioned last week, there was a group of Jews in Palestine called the Zealots. And these were the ones that hated the Roman rule. And they, every time they could snipe at a Roman garrison from the hills, they fought guerrilla warfare. They would come down and kill them. They were trying to drive them out of the land. finally they whipped up such a fervor that the Romans tried for like 10 years to quell that. Finally, they brought in a Roman emperor, or actually a Roman general, who came in and completely squashed the effort. He broke through Jerusalem. He tore the synagogue down. They carted off all the belongings of the Jews. They tore every stone from every stone. They flattened it all. They burned the reference library. They burned the records library that had all the records and the histories of the Jews. And so all of that happened, but what happened in between is that the Christians had a vision of that happening. So many of the Christians sort of melted away into the countryside. And so the Jews accused them of treason and not helping to support the Jewish faith. And once that temple was burned, there was a forever split between Christians and Jews. Jews would never allow them in the synagogue again. They were never considered to be a part of Judaism. They were forever split. And that's what we pick up today, because they're forever split. So they're having to meet in houses. They're having to meet in upstairs rooms. They're having to meet any place there's a place to meet, because they can't go to the synagogues today. They don't have the fine buildings. They don't have all the trappings of the infrastructure of the Jewish religion to help them. And also, many of them were afraid for their lives, and so they fled. They fled Jerusalem, and they went out to other lands. And it's interesting that God uses that persecution of Christians to drive Christians out to spread the word about Christ. They were on fire for Christ. They were the second generation just after the apostles. They hadn't really seen much of Christ and his death, but they had witnessed and talked to people who were eyewitnesses. So John was one of the last ones left, and John took on this revered role within the church. But John had moved out to Ephesus, and he was out away from Jerusalem today because of his own safety. And so John is out in Jerusalem. He's still causing trouble. He's still, you know, preaching to the Ephesians. He's starting churches. He's, you know, preaching the gospel. But he's really the last one left. And all of the circular letters of Paul and all the others are circulating around the churches in the region. The normal church service at that time was one that started with prayer. They would start with prayer. They would sing hymns. They would read scripture. Someone would get up and talk, have a little discussion, what we would call a sermon today or a homily or whatever the thing is. And at the end of the service, they would have what's known as the decision time, where people would come down. And because, you know, many were added to the church after Peter's preaching and all of the things that happened. So that's kind of the form of the church, wherever it was. I mean, more or less they would sing depending on who was there. Somebody would get up and preach. There was no defined preacher. As long as there was an apostle there, the apostle would lead most of it. But in some of these smaller churches, there wasn't an apostle. So they had, you know, like many churches today, you would go sit down and somebody would have a word from the Lord, and they'd get up and they'd walk up front and they'd share a word with the Lord. And so that's the way the early church functioned. And so that's the way the church was spread. And very quickly, three things begin to take root. And you see them in Paul's letters. Paul talks about, he talks about people called overseers. It's the word episkopos in Greek. He talks about those who are elders in the church. The word is presbyteros in the church. And then he talks about the ones that are pastor teachers. And I don't remember what the Greek word is there, but it's the word for shepherd. It's the word for shepherd teacher. And so those three offices really were the same person. They were the person that led the local flock. They were either, but episkopos had an idea of an overseer, kind of a head person. The presbyteros had the notion of an elder, so someone who was older, wiser in the church, maybe had been a member of church for a long time. And then in the churches where a pastor or pastor teacher was, it was the leader of the flock. It was somebody who took a direct hands-on care of the flock, just like a shepherd would with his sheep. And in addition, in all of these titles, all of these forms, there were deacons. And so you had this level of what we would call preacher or leader today, whether they were an episcopos or whether they were presbyteros or whether they were a shepherd leader. They were the leader of the flock, and then you had the deacons. And that was the offices of the church, and that's the way it was all over the place. Now, many of the churches that came out of a Jewish heritage like the idea of the episcopos and the presbyteros because they came out of a structured environment where they had priests and they had chief priests and they had scribes and Pharisees and they had all these offices with various functions that ran the synagogue. And so you saw churches begin to migrate to different types of structure based on the nature of the church that was there. And all of these had two characteristics to them because they were a Christian church. The characteristics were baptism, exclusively baptism by immersion, because that's what the Jews did, that's what the pagans did, and that's the way they baptized. Baptizo is a Greek word that means immersed, immersion. And so that's the way the churches did baptism at the time. They also did something they called Lord's Supper. And they had it usually on a Sunday, and they would do it in remembrance of the Lord. And we do that in our churches today. And when Jim does a Lord's Supper service, he reads out of Corinthians or he reads out of Luke, depending on where he's doing it, or particularly the style of the service. But always there's two elements. There's a bread element, which is supposed to be the body of Christ that has died for us and he's given all for us. And the blood of Christ, which really becomes a new covenant for us. And if you go back and you read those passages, or you listen to Jim, he'll talk about the blood as a new covenant. Well, to the Christians, a new covenant meant something very specific. It meant they were different. It meant they were not the same as they used to be. It meant a new birth. It meant an awakening of a new spiritual side to them that they'd never had before. And so that became very powerful. So in all of the church, all of this universal church, you had a form of government, which was a pastor-led, in whichever form the pastor took, a deacon service level in two ordinances within the church. That was a common theme in all of the churches. And that continued on for 100 years or so in the church. Now, many things happened in the church. The roles began to change a little bit. The episcopos or the overseer role began to take on more of an overseer of multiple churches. The elder function began to move into like a board of elders. It began to move into a number of elders within a church, one of which would preach or they would alternate preaching. In an episcopal or an episcopos style, typically that person doesn't preach, but he has an elder that works for him that preaches. And so that's the way that works. In the pastor style, there is no episcopos. There may or may not be elders, but they're led by the pastor of the church. The deacons also get different roles in the church depending on how it was set up. Well, another word for episcopos in English is the word bishop. And so as a part of the growth of the church, the churches that went to an episcopal strategy or an overseer strategy begin to, as all churches do, you have a church, a denomination, let's say a Baptist, there will be stronger pastors than other pastors. They will rise to certain levels within the peer community. Pastors will look up to some pastors, and maybe it's been Rick Warren in the past, maybe it's been Dr. Stanley, maybe it's been whoever it's been, you know, who have risen to a certain level. People look up to them and they take guidance from them, and even though they're not called a bishop, they sort of take on a role of being a mentor and a leader within the church. And as that role began to grow in the church because of a couple of very big things. As you know, when we study Paul is a proponent of grace and not law. Paul is a proponent of live your faith in front of others. Don't just do the things the law prescribes, but live your faith. Put it in your heart and live your faith. So you can begin to see a little bit of a split beginning in the churches in about 100 AD in the thought process of how they run their church. Still one universal church, still one church, family of God, of Christian believers. But there were some churches that became more legalistic, some that became more driven by what they call the Holy Spirit. Those things are still alive in the churches today. And today you see churches that are considered fundamental churches. You see churches that are considered conservative churches. You see churches that are considered liberal churches. And you see churches that are considered to be very left of center or radical churches on the left side. And those are existent in today's church world, just like they were in 100 AD. Certainly they've refined their message. They've gotten cleverer about the way they sell their product. But they have essentially grown out of a first century deal. So in essence, the first 100 years of Christian faith, let's say up to AD 100, was the settling of the church, the death of Christ, the formation of the church, the God forcing them out of Jerusalem, forcing them to disperse, to spread the word, the catching of fire of the churches all over around the Mediterranean area within the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire generally left them alone because they weren't concerned with what they believed as long as they didn't break the law. But about 100 AD, things changed. As you begin to see, and we see today, there are churches that are really on the fringe element of belief. And so there were some churches that believed that Paul's writings were really everything, and that the Holy Spirit was really all they needed to have. So the Old Testament wasn't important, the Gospels wasn't important, because that was in the past. Now all that was important was living Paul's Holy Spirit-driven, grace-given, love-based church. And as a movement, they became heavy proselytizers, if you will. They began to go sell their product. They began to go preach. And they began to convert people. And they began to convert the Romans. And the Romans begin to look at this now no longer like the Jews, who were basically self-contained and were a closed community. They didn't go out and proselytize. If you wanted to be a Jew, you came to them. And you had a whole set of hurdles to go through to become a Jew. They would allow it, but it was a whole set of rules. Well, these Christians were out proselytizing. Well, all of the Christians were doing that. Even the traditional Christians were out preaching the word. They were just looking for people that had a different thought process than the others. One was more pagan. One was more Hellenistic. Didn't come from the basic roots of Judaism. And so you begin to see a split in the church develop in terms of thoughts and views of God, and views of salvation, and views of all of that. And these views forced the church, the universal church, to make steps towards what we call today orthodoxy. And the way they did that was they began to do things like an Apostles' Creed. They began to do things like systematize the books of the New Testament and decide which books were really the right books and how to read these books in context with the other books. So they began to do the hard work of building the infrastructure for how the church was to operate. And so for about 100 years, you had a tremendous upheaval in the church as the church began to sort through what was orthodox and what wasn't. Orthodox really was adopting what the mainstream of the Christian beliefs were, which were really this universal church. It wasn't out on the fringe element. And so the fringe elements were beginning to be discouraged. They were beginning to be taught against, and they were beginning to be preached against. And you had two fringe elements in particular that were causing problems. And you read them in Paul's letters. One of them is what we call the Gnostics. And these are the people that believed that matter was evil in every form. The earth was evil, flowers were evil, people were evil, because we were made up of matter. The only thing pure was spirit. All spirit was pure, all matter was evil. And therefore, they had this thought that it didn't matter what you did in your body, because your body was essentially evil anyway. It was what you thought in your mind. And so they didn't care about behavior. They didn't care about anything like that. They were very strong in preaching the spirit side. We would call them today spiritualists. they're very big on spirit, but don't give me any guidelines. Don't give me any rules. Don't tell me about who God is and what God wants, because that's all matter-driven. We're spirit-driven. So we see a lot of that begin to happen. The other fault of that is that they looked at it and they said, because of that, Christ could not have been God, because Christ was human. If he was human, he touched humans. Therefore, he couldn't be God, because spirit and matter don't ever touch one another. So he had to be a first or second or third or fourth degree emanation from God, because he had to be impure enough that he could deal with humans, but yet godly enough that he had some elements of God left in him. So that began to be the first big heresy in the church, and the church fought that very much. Although you see it today in different forms. You see it in this whole movement of spiritualism, you know, where God is everywhere. And we see it in early America in what we call deism. Some of our founding fathers were deists, and they weren't Christians. They believed in God, but they didn't believe particularly in Jesus, and they didn't believe in any of his miracles. And so they took a different view of God. We would look at them today and say, decidedly not Christian. They believe some things about the Christian walk, but they weren't Christians. At least not that we can tell, at least from their writings. So that element started then. The other one was what they called docetism, and I know you don't care about these, but docetism was the other one, because what that meant was Jesus really wasn't real. He only seemed to be real. He was really a figment of our imagination, and the death on the cross really wasn't real. The Spirit of God came when he was baptized by John, came into his body, and before he went to the cross in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he cried out to God, the Spirit was taken. So it was just matter that came into the world, and it was just matter that got crucified. God himself didn't suffer. God himself didn't have the pain. It only seemed like he did. And so so we see people today that want to allegorize the miracles in the Bible. They want to say, well, that really didn't happen. Jesus really didn't die on the cross. He really didn't raise from the dead. That, you know, that was just a myth that was perpetuated by the early church. And so they don't call themselves that today, but the same heresy, the same thought process exists today, and has since about 100, really since about 60 or 70 A.D., because Paul was beginning to fight this in some of his latter letters. So all of this was beginning to happen. The church took this view of orthodoxy. They gave the bishops some power that the bishops had never happened, and they ask a question, which is a question that there's really two questions that all the church deals with. First question is, I'm a Christian. I come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. I get myself baptized. I come to church, and then all of a sudden, I fall away. And I do what they consider to be horrible sins. You know, I'm an apostate of the church. I commit adultery. I blaspheme God. There were some offenses that were considered very detrimental. And so the church, as a general rule, excommunicated those people. They put them outside the church. They said, you can't, obviously you're not a Christian, because if you were, you'd never fail. You became a Christian, and that forgave all your previous sins, but now you have to be perfect from now on, because you can't commit these sins or you fall away. And that was the way the church dealt with it. Very orthodox, very punishment-oriented. And then there was another movement that developed that said, hey, that can't be right. That can't be right. So there was a movement of forgiveness, and that caused a pretty big discussion within the church. Who can be forgiven and who can't be forgiven? Who commits a sin that's so unpardonable that they can't be forgiven? And when does that, if that sin is before salvation, can they still be saved? What if that sin comes after salvation? Does that negate their salvation? So the church went through a lot of upheaval in about the 150, 100 to 200 year time frame, thinking about those subjects. Both sides argued. The side that really won, but won in a narrow victory, if you will, was the side that said forgiveness is appropriate. As we're forgiven, we should forgive others. And so the church developed this elaborate scheme for forgiveness. And I do mean scheme in a bad way, but I don't mean to refer that to you. They would say, okay, so look, all right, so let's take sins and let's categorize them. these are really the worst sins, and I'm going to name them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm going to call these things really bad sins. These other sins are maybe sins that aren't so bad, and they're a different type of sin. And then there's these sins that normal people commit because they're ignorant, they don't know any better, they just commit them out of ignorance. And so they had three classes of sins. So they developed punishments for those classes of sins, or they developed payments for those classes of sins. So if you were a sinner and you committed a sin against the church and it was of the bottom class, maybe you went to the bishop and you confessed your sins and you the bishop forgave you as long as you did penance. And the penance would be based on the type of sin you did. If it was a more serious sin, it may involve money that you had to pay to get absolved of that sin. And of course, if it was the most serious kind of sin, you had to pay a lot of money to the church to get them to forgive that sin. And so what happened was the churches began to invest in the bishops powers that had never been given beyond God before. These were powers of God to forgive sin, to absolve people of sin. And so the powers began to be pushed out to the bishops to do that, because they had to have a way to bring these people back into the church. And the commentaries never say this, but you know, this is an opportunity for the church to basically consolidate power and to begin to regulate people's behavior and to begin to do a lot of things. And if they got off the treadmill, they could collect some money and get them back on the treadmill, and they could feel good about it because they got paid something. They came forward and they confessed it, and all of that. That created some very deep divisions within the church. And those divisions really were the basis of many of the splits that happened in the middle part of the church, age, like in the 14th and 15th century, because the church began to abuse those things terribly, and they began to consolidate power. But right now, and to enforce orthodoxy, it's kind of like they do a good thing to do that. I heard a quote the other day, which I'm trying to figure out who said it, but it's a modern guy, and he said, every movement, if successful, becomes a business. Then it becomes a big business, and finally it becomes a racket. And I think you can, if you said to yourself, let's take a look at the environmental movement. It started out wonderfully. It turned into a business. It's now a big business. And you could argue the fact that it's a racket right now. You could say the same about the race movement. You could say the same about a lot of movements that we've seen. You could probably say the same thing about the Jesus movement. It started pure of heart. Then it became a business. Then it became a big business. And in many ways today, it's become a racket. And you've seen abuses in the church. People go back to the basics. You've seen people pull away and try to go back to the core beliefs of the church because they don't like where it's going. And so I would say to you that that's an interesting quote. And it helps to think of that not just in a religious sense, but in a real sense, because people are people. You know, if you get in a movement and it's going well, you decide, well, I could probably make money doing this. And if I can make money doing this, then the people that are making money, some are going to get bigger and better at making money. And when they do, then they begin to cut corners and they begin to forget why the movement started. And they begin to forget their core principles. And then it turns into something that the movement never intended for it to be. It turns into a scheme or a racket. And so, you could say, based on history today, if you look back at the early church, you can begin to see the process of moving along that stage of development of the movement. The Jesus movement became powerful within the Hebrew faith. It became powerful as an evangelism tool to grow the faith. As a part of that, a lot of things happened to make the movement better, to make it stronger, to coalesce it, to standardize its message, to make it orthodox, to punish people that got out of line, to do all of the other kinds of stuff. And all of that is fine, because in any kind of movement, you need some structure. It's only when it goes to the next step or two that it becomes a problem. And we haven't seen that yet. Everyone's trying to do this properly. So in the first and second century, like up through 300 AD, is just part of the maturing factor of the church, how it's set up. But people always see the slippery slope. They always see you start down a path for which you can't control it. It's going to go places you don't want it to go. And so by consolidating the power for bishops to forgive sin, absolve sin, and bring people back into the church through forgiveness, the universal church was complete in terms of its orthodox view of the world. And so at about 300 AD, you begin to 275, let's say, you begin to see the Orthodox Church begin to take shape as what it's going to become. Then something happened. What happened was the Roman Empire, of which they were operating within, began to fail. The Roman Empire began to struggle. They began to have problems in their provinces. The emperors became corrupt. The problems in the empire became legion in terms of, you know, they couldn't control populations. And all of a sudden, they needed a scapegoat for what was going to happen. And you know today, if there's a problem in the economy, you know who gets blamed for it. If there's a problem in any facet of our life, government has somebody else to blame but themselves. And that's just the first political, I won't go any farther on the political analogies, but it's a common practice to blame the guy that was before you because he's the guy that did all this. My end of the boat's clean, you know, my end of the boat's dry, it wasn't me, it was somebody else, it was them to look at. And the Roman Empire began to look at who the scapegoat for the problems. Nero, the city of Rome burned. People think Nero may have actually set the fire himself, but he blamed the Christians for it. And so many Christians started being persecuted under Nero. And this is where Paul died. This is where Peter died. In like 60 AD, they were part of this first wave of persecution of Christians to take out all the apostles and the leaders that they could catch. John was the only one out of line, and they left him alone because he was old, and they put him on this island to get rid of him, put him on Patmos to isolate him because he had too many followers over there, and they didn't consider him much of a troublemaker anymore because he was getting older. So, you know, they persecuted all of the apostles have been killed off. Then the pressure lets off for a while until you get a guy named Decius, or however you want to pronounce it, Roman guy. He begins to think this Christian movement is growing. People are beginning to say Jesus is Lord. In fact, one of the sayings of the church was Jesus is Lord. You know, and when people would greet one another, Jesus is Lord. And that became a saying in the Roman Empire. They were terrified of that because of the fall. So they began to create this idea of Caesar worship. Caesar is Lord. And they begin to enforce that in the communities. And if you wouldn't say Caesar is Lord, then you were punished. All they required you to do, by the way, is say Caesar is Lord in front of somebody. And then you could go about and practice your religion the other 364 days of the year. But you had to say that once a year. For Christians, that became a real problem. And so many Christians were martyred during that time because they would not say Caesar is Lord. Many of the early Christian martyrs, Polycarp, Justin, martyred. A lot of people were martyred because they would not do that. Christians were burned at the stake. They were sent to the lions. All of that happened because Christians would not renounce God. The other thing Christians did was they held themselves apart. They fellowshipped among one another. They loved one another. And so the church communities exhibited love, even to the point where the Romans noticed that, and they admired it, but they didn't like the object of it, which was Christ. They wanted that to be for the state. They wanted that to be for Rome. And so they began to root Christians out. Christians wouldn't participate in the social gladiator things of the day. They didn't see any point in watching people kill one another in the gladiator arena. They were concerned about it. The other thing Christians did, which is kind of an interesting thing I didn't really realize, is Christians had a belief that all of God's children were important to him. Whether they were a slave, or whether they were a Roman, or whether they were Greek, or whether they were Jew, or whether they were a pagan, that all of them were important. And the Romans had this notion that if you weren't a Roman, if you were killed, they threw you outside the city for dogs to eat, birds to eat. They just didn't care. You were treated like a dead animal, like a carcass. And the Christians begin to take those people and bury them. And they begin to develop within their church areas cemeteries. They would buy land associated with the church, and they would use that to bury people who the state threw away. The state didn't care about. Of course, their own members as well. And so the notion of a church cemetery, and we don't see it much, like we don't have a church cemetery here, but many of the country churches around have church cemeteries because in the early days, you couldn't depend on anybody else to take care of your dead. And so the churches took care of their own. They didn't have national cemeteries that you could go pay to be in, or state cemeteries or city cemeteries. They just didn't have them. And so the churches filled that role. And so they were they performed a great service, but it set them apart, and they looked different. And anytime people are different, others are afraid of them. They're scared of them. They don't like them. They feel threatened by them. And so the churches begin to be persecuted. And all of that continued until Constantine became emperor of Rome. And I'm going to talk about that next time. But Constantine became emperor of Rome, and then there was good news and bad news with that. But so all of these churches begin to suffer, and they begin this whole notion of if I were captured by Rome and I were taken in, they would flog me, they would beat me, they would do everything under the sun to make me say Caesar is Lord. If I would not do that and I died a martyr, they were called by the church confessors. They were people that withstood the whole test and became confessors. Many people, however, knowing that all they had to do was say Jesus is Lord and they could get out, would say Caesar is Lord, and they would escape. And the church had this whole set of what they called apostates now, who were probably 75% of the church, who had been persecuted and decided that they would say that just to get out, and they would go about their business and do their stuff. Once a year, they would go by and say this. So the church began to understand that in the midst of this conversion of thousands and thousands of people, there were people that were committed Christians and there were people that were not so committed. They would give up on the principle of Jesus is Lord. They would give up on the principle of dedication to Him and Him alone. And they had this major crisis within the church of apostasy that all fed into this whole notion of how do we give forgiveness and how do we bring them back in. And so the church began to go through this upheaval internally. And again, the way that manifested itself was more orthodoxy and more rules and more procedures and more payments and more, going through penance and doing these, various things you do to demonstrate that you're sorrowful for what you do. And then another thing began to happen, and that is the arguing about the event. The event being the life, death, resurrection of Jesus Christ. The early church preached Jesus' resurrection. They preached a risen Lord. That's what they preached. And the church began to turn from that mission to preach Christian behavior. Here's the way a Christian acts. Not here's why you want to be a Christian. Here's the Christian idea. Here's the power of Christ's death and what He's done for you. But the church began to preach behavioral messages. And so the church began to diverge from its historic mission of preaching evangelical sermons to preaching sermons that the people needed to learn about how to live as a Christian, what to do, what not to do. And all of that was fraught with the idea that they had to make up those rules because the Bible is not full of those rules. They had to establish this set of rules about how a Christian lives. And so it even got to the point where people were arguing about whether, as I mentioned before, Christ's death was really real or whether it was His body was ever resurrected. And so there began to seep in these heresies in the church because the message of the church was beginning to get watered down, was beginning to get diluted to satisfy the needs of the masses who were there. And all of that began to evolve into what we would call today, you see it today, is a social gospel, where we talk about how we interact with the world. What would Jesus do in the world? We want to live like Jesus would want us to live. But we don't talk about who Jesus is. We don't talk about why he died. We don't talk about the whosoever of John 3:16. We don't talk about Christ's message of openness to the church and getting people to believe. We talk about how to act and how to do. So we see many Christian movements today that are based around single ideas, whether it's the poor or whether it is environmental issue, taking care of God's kingdom, the nature part of it, or whether it is pure evangelism and nothing else. I'm going to go to countries to evangelize, but I'm not going to disciple. So we begin to see people focus on areas of the gospel away from the central message that the church had. And that began to grow during this period. And we see the roots of it today in our current society. And two things, I'm getting close to the end, so don't get too worried. I've only got 12 more pages. Actually, I have a few to draw shortly. We begin to see the development of theology. Theology is made up of two Greek words. It's made up of the word theos, which means of God. And it's made up of the word logos, which means the word or mind of God. Or the thought of God. So theology was the study of how we think like God, how we put ourselves into the thinking about what God meant, what God wanted us to do. Theology was developed by the early church, put in the Apostles' Creed, put in a lot of different substantive ways so that we understood the principles of our faith. We understood some of those things today. The Apostles' Creed has modified itself over the years. It's gotten a little more political than it was back in the early days when it was written. But nevertheless, it still distills the majority of what Christian faith is about today. But theology is not the same as religion. And I want to make that point. Theology is the idea of the mind of God, thinking like God, thinking about God. Religion is our attempt to put together a structure on earth that allows us to live out what we believe. So the religions that we have, whether it's the Jewish religion, their faith is dictated by many of the rules of the Old Testament, but you know they added a lot to those when they built their Talmuds and all their other things. In the Christian faith, you have all these rules and regulations that are different by denomination. We haven't talked about them yet. We won't talk about them for a while. But denominations have different sets of ideas and thoughts, and they systematize the way we worship God in what's called a religion. So Baptist religion is different from Methodism, or different from Presbyterianism, or different from Lutheranism, or Episcopalian, or Anglican, or AME, or the Holiness Movement. All of the movements that we've had in our churches, they're all different in some respect because of the form of the worship that they do. Not necessarily their fundamental beliefs, although some of the beliefs are different. So religion and theology are separate terms, and they begin to get separated more and more by the church, and people begin to separate those as thoughts. So during this time, and we've talked about this, we've talked about the history of the Bible began to be assembled and put together, and there were lots of disputes about which books were canonical. Canonical meaning that they are the right book. The canon means ruler, so that they were the right measure of what God said. They were canonical, which meant they were the proper set of books to be in. So we look at our Bible, and we have an Old Testament and a New Testament canon, list of books. And that's not the way it's always been. In fact, that's not the way it is today. If I look at my Bible, I have the Old Testament, and I have the New Testament. I don't have the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is a set of books that was developed in the period of about 400 BC up through about maybe 50 BC. And those are books that are not in the Jewish canon. They're not in what we believe the New Testament is, but they are in the Catholic Bible. They're considered to be part of the Catholic canon, the Old Testament canon. We don't believe they're God-inspired, but we believe they're historical books. But they're just not God-inspired. They're like a lot of other books that were historical in the time. So there still are some differences in Bibles today in terms of our Bible, the Catholic Bible, Bibles built off of the old Latin Vulgate. There's a lot of differences in Bibles. We'll talk about them as we go on it. So I've already talked about some of this stuff. So you're all leaving now. I can take that a couple of ways. So we talked about bishops, and I want to get to this point before everybody's gone. What do we make of bishops? Bishops were in the early church. Bishops were part of the structure of the early church. There are three things to say about bishops, and three different beliefs about bishops, and you see it existent today in the church structures that we have today. The first thing about bishops I'll say is, there are many people when this bishop form of government was formed, said that they willfully and sinfully put this in place as directly opposed to what the early church taught about the way churches should function. That it was a willful thing against the apostolic pattern of a church run by an apostle or by a leader. So they willfully distorted it. You see that today played out in what we would call congregational churches. Baptists are part of that, but a lot of congregational churches who believe that in the congregation, that their pastor, like everybody in the congregation, stands directly before God. We don't have intermediaries that go between us. And so that's one form of thought. The second form of thought was that this was a response to the church to a real live need in the church, and they made the best decision they could, and that the church will always evolve its structure according to the needs of the people. And you see this played out in what we would call the Anglican, the Episcopal, the Lutheran, what we would call high churches today, those that have a very strong liturgical background. They come from an Orthodox background. They have, the bishops pick their pastors and they move them around. They leave them for a year or two and then they move them around because it's an Episcopal or it's a bishop structure that they operate in. Certainly the Catholics fall into that as well. And then the last way to look at it is, this was divinely inspired. It was given by God. God provided this guidance. And so therefore, it was not only binding on the churches then, but it's binding on the churches today. And that's really the Roman Catholic view of this structure. Also the Orthodox view of this structure. That it is a binding structure. It's a structure that's in place today. And if you don't have that structure, many times they think you're not going to heaven. You're off in the fringes in the weeds somewhere. And so there are three distinct beliefs that grew out of this time, and they manifest themselves today in the three major branches of Christianity that we have. We have this Orthodox structure branch, we have this Catholic and near Catholic branch, and then we have this congregational branch. In the congregational branch, you find your Assemblies of God, you find your Brethren, you find your Moravians, you find your Baptists, you find a lot of the congregational style churches that are in that mode. We'll get to how they develop later. But anyway, that's the way that happened, and that's some of the seeds that were planted in the very early times of the church. So we think the church today suffers all these indignities and all these fights. Well, this has been going on since about 50 or 60 AD. There's been fights in the church, there's been splits, there's been arguments, I mean heated arguments, major disputes, schisms in the church because of fundamental beliefs. And, politics and religion are the two things that people are passionate about, and their children and their pets. But, in terms of major structures, politics and religion, when you go to a social party, you try to avoid those because they get you in trouble. You cause heated debates among people and splits in friendships and families and all other things like that. So, it's kind of interesting to see how that all split. The last thing that happened in this part of the church history was what I'm going to call apostles to intellectuals. As a part of this orthodoxy, as a part of this restructuring of the church, there began to be genuine scholars within the church. There hadn't been up to this time. I mean, you would call Paul a scholar because he was a scholar of Jewish history. But general scholars about church movements, and they'd really thought about theology, and they processed it, and they became very powerful. And the major school in there was in Alexandria, not Virginia, but in Egypt. And so the major school was in Alexandria. And they developed two people that became very prominent in the early church. And that's a man named Origen and a man named Clement. And you'll read a lot of quotes if you read early church history from Origen and Clement. These were guys that were very powerful in the early church. And there's a lot of things that they did, but one thing they did was they took the message of the church to the intellectuals of the day. So through this university system, if you will, they begin to compete for philosophical ideas. They begin to teach philosophies, the Christian philosophy, in the church. Many people thought that was heresy. They thought it was horrible. Tertullian is one. He was a church leader. He thought it was a slippery slope. If you go about mixing in the world and teaching philosophy, it's going to take you to a place you don't want to go. And he based that on the notion that in Corinthians, Paul said, you know, we're supposed to be in the world, not of the world. And, you know, and John says that we're to be a light to the darkness. We're not to be the darkness. We're to be a light of the darkness. But they said that unless you engage people as sinners, unless you engage them on their level, like Jesus did with tax collectors and others, you'll never be able to bring these people to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. So a whole movement of intellectualism began in the church, and you begin to see all of these people that were scholars, and you read them all through church history, and you see about church leaders who had dramatic effects on the church and their writings and what they did. But they would get a little too far, and Clement got a little too far, and Origen took that and got a little too far beyond that. He believed, and probably many Christians hope, that in the final analysis, God will find a way to bring those people that have been resistant to the Lord to salvation. But he went from a dream to making it part of his theology that God would even convert the devil back to be someone who would be under his grace. And of course, that was pure heresy to the church. And so they didn't burn him at the stake, but they threw him out, and the Romans threw him out because he got into a lot of trouble and finally ended up dying because he'd been beaten and everything else. And he ended up dying about 250 or 300 AD, I think is about the time of this. And so we begin to see the roots of what's going to set the stage for this next part of Christianity, which is the part that takes us through the Roman Empire up until the Middle Ages and all the things that happened there, which we're going to talk about next week. But I want to say that if you really begin to think about the early church, and you set aside all of the, I'll call them church traditions that they try to teach people about what really happened in the early church, why their church is really the right form of government, none other is. You have to understand that at this time, 300 AD, there's no popes. There's just bishops. There's no Catholic, there's no Roman Catholic Church. There's just the universal church. The term Catholic was used again because it's a Latin word which was prominent in the New Testament, or prominent in the Roman times. So you had this Catholic, small c Catholic church that was the prevalent church type with bishops and all of this stuff that was pervasive in the Roman Empire. And I'll just say that I remember, I may have told you the story before, but when I was with IBM and I worked in Boca Raton, I was part of the development of the IBM PC group back in the early 80s. And I wasn't one of the first people in. I was probably, I don't remember, employee number 70 or 75 in the PC organization. And we worked for about a year to get this PC launched and announced and took off like gangbusters, as you probably know. And I remember Don Estridge, who was our elder at the time. He was our preacher. He was our teacher. He was our guide. He came in to us and gathered us all in Florida Atlantic University and said, "I've got good news and I've got bad news for you. Good news is IBM loves us. The bad news is IBM loves us." And what you're going to see next week is the good news for the church is the Roman Empire loves them. Now, the bad news is the Roman Empire loves them because it made such dramatic changes in the church that really set the stage for a lot of the anger and things that happen in the church. So if you have any time and you want to read a book like this, I would suggest you get it. The sections are separatable. You can read a section. It is self-contained. You don't have to know everything that happened before. But the section on the Roman Empire comes to church is kind of an interesting section, and we'll talk about that. Any questions or comments, anything you want to bring up? I skipped a lot of stuff, by the way, because I couldn't do it. I could take four lessons to do this in some detail, so I tried to just hit the highlights. Any thoughts? Okay, well, maybe I'll have more than this next week. You never know. So anyway, let's have a prayer. Lord, thank you for this time, and thank you for the guidance you gave to the early church. And Lord, it's important for us to be Orthodox. It's important for us to know where we come from. It's so important, Lord, for us to know the rock from which we're cut. But Lord, it's also important to remember the core beliefs that we have and why we became a Christian, and the basic structure of our belief in you, and how it should always color and guide us in everything we do. Lord, help us just be followers of you and listen to your Spirit. Lord, we also pray for the service to come, for the pastor and the singers and everyone who's involved, that it meet the needs of everyone who comes. And we just ask this in your holy name. Amen. Thank you all.